Session number 27237, Reel 9.
Mr. Robert Nowarski, Reel 9. Now, we were talking about this tour of duty you had with flying Spitfire 5s or 5Bs with 316 Squadron at Northolt in the later stages, which was from September 42 through to August 43.
So that's right, yes.
Are there any other things you remember from that tour of duty?
Well, the flight were more or less much of a muchness, really. I mean, we flew quite a number of sorties, and we don't always met opposition, but you nearly always were shot at from the ground things, and you could. You knew that you were being shot at because you suddenly saw white sort of puffs of exploding artillery sort of shells in your vicinity. You see, say within 50 yards or 100 yards or so. So they were probably quite good at estimating the actual height that we were flying. Well, you would be flying at about say 20,000-25,000 feet. You see, and yet they had it quite. One thing I remember actually that at that particular time it was very important to sort of scan the sky to look for enemy fighters, and my eyesight must have been very good because I could usually spot them before anybody else could see them actually in the squadron, and I would then say to my leader, you see now the bunch of several aircraft there, say at 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whatever, you see, and sure enough few moments later it would have been confirmed, you see there. And that would have happened on several occasions.
Anything else? Any particular missions you refer? I think you said they're blurred together a bit now.
A bit, pardon?
The missions are blurred together a bit.
Well yes, because they were all sort of much of a muchness, really. You see, there wasn't, so one didn't, so if there wasn't much activity, one didn't differ very much from another. You see, you always saw enemy flak or the sort of artillery fire trying to get you, you see. But it was just a sort of accepted. I don't honestly think that we have lost many aircraft due to enemy attack fire, actually. Not at that time. Later on in the war, yes. We lost quite a number, actually, but not at that time.
Now, anything towards the end of the tour? Were you getting more nervous, or as before,
not,
were you
not
all right?
Really, no, you just live from day to day. You didn't think about being nervous, you see. It's not really a... I don't honestly know, but you thought that you could go on and on and on forever, you see.
Now, so that went on till August 43.
Yes.
And then you came off that tour of duty.
I came off tour of duty, and I was then stationed. I was sent back to an OTU.
Now that on your notes, that's number 61. OTV, or is it
OTU?
OTU. Yeah, it's an
operational training unit, and that was at Montford Bridge in Cheshire, and Harden was the sort of satellite aerodrome of it. And all we did there actually was to again train young pilots that have just finished their secondary. flying training, and they were being converted to Spitfires and Mustangs. Then again, the duties where you just taught them formation flying and tactics and firing and low flying and there is. I remember two particular incidents actually from.
Well,
from
tell us about them because they were both nearly fatal, weren't they? I mean.
Yes. They're both nearly fatal. One was worse than the other. When I was taking a section of sort of three aircraft to myself and to my two wingmen, one on the right side, one on the left side, and I was waiting the formation takeoff. And during one particular one, my right side wingman sort of slew his aircraft right towards me, and it finished. Actually, we nearly touched. We finished virtually on top of me as we were climbing. You see, we are still very low. I couldn't get any lower because of the trees and everything else. You see, and I couldn't escape to the left because there's my other wingman there on the left side. How we didn't collide, I don't know. You see, but that was a bloody awful experience, actually, because you thought that was just about the end of your.
Did you speak to him afterwards?
Oh, yeah, of course, yes. Afterwards, you see, when I tackled him about this, he didn't think he did anything wrong. You see, so he thought he was all right. You see, there's no. He didn't think it was any different from any other. And I know that I have, since that particular thing, I tried to avoid him actually to have a, for that he wouldn't be flying with me again, you see. I'd rather palm him off to one of the other instructors, you see, let them.
And there was another incident, you said. What was that?
Well, and that is when we are sort of teaching attaches, you know. So you were being attacked and you were then trying to get out of it, you see. And there was another chap, actually. I mean, he just about collided with me, you see. I only just got away. But these were things that you were almost... You almost wished that you were back in Squadron rather than instructing, you see. Although at that time we would say that the... sky full of Messerschmitts was a far safer place, provided you knew where they were, you see, than instructing anything, you see. But that, of course, was a great exaggeration, you see, but if you knew where they were, you were sort of half all right anyway, because if you were sort of more experienced, but you knew how to get away from that sort of situation.
Now, one thing about that place was the accommodation, because were you at Howard and Castle?
We were accommodated in the officer's mess at Harden, I think it was, or Harden, yes. But virtually next to Harden was the Harden Castle, which was a private residence of Gladstone in the years gone by, and that was converted into a training unit for Wren officers there, you see. And so there were a bunch of very pretty girls, actually, or I suppose they must have been all 19, 20, 21 or thereabouts. I think there must have been about 20 of them or thereabouts, or taking their course before being commissioned, and used to go to dances there, and you know, when you one 20-year-old meets another 20-year-old, well, you might end up in a bout of kissing or whatever. It's not really.
Anything else about your time as an instructor?
Nothing really, no.
So you were there till February 44?
Pardon?
You were there till February 44?
I did literally from February 44, yes. And then I was then posted back to operational duties to 302 Squadron back again. I was in 302 Squadron before that. And that was stationed at Northolt, actually, when I came back to 302.
Now, they were by then, they were flying the Spitfire 9s.
Oh, yeah, by that time
now
we were flying Spitfire 9s.
What did you think of the Spitfire? We talked about them briefly, but tell me, how much better were the Spitfire 9s?
The Spitfire 9s, the main difference, actually, between the 5s and the 9s was that the Spitfire 5 was very good up to about 20,000 feet, or 18 or 20,000 feet. Yeah. Then the performance would fall off a bit, in comparison to other aircraft. Now, with the Spitfire 9, you had a second turbo, I suppose, really, boost come in at about 22,000, 23,000 feet. And that would give you a new sort of spurt of enhanced performance, and so that you were then at that height, you were then better than anything else that we met. Say, especially Fokkerplanes, because Fokkerplanes would be round about this sort of between 15,000 and 25,000 feet. They were quite a bit better than Spitfire 5s. But over 24,000-25,000 feet, then of course the 9 was better than the Fokkerplanes. You see, there's no comparison, you see, really there. Well, no. There was comparison, yes, but it was better. You weren't outflown, you see, really. But
now, during this period, you were escorting American bomber raids.
Yes, that's the first
time. Are they daylight bomb raids?
But
these are the daylight.
Oh, yes, they're all daylight. Yes. I mean, all the escorts were in daylight anyway that we used to do. Oh, yeah, yes. And it was quite a sight, actually. But they used to fly quite high, usually 25,000 feet. And we would be one of a number of squadrons that would be escorting them. They usually sort of blanket bomb really in sort of things like in Lille or Amiens, the marshalling yards for Abbeville, or further south of Rouen and Caen, and then again Brest.
So France generally.
Oh yes. Just over France. What well, and also Belgium and Holland. I don't know, if we would escort them, say, over Holland or Belgium, we would first of all fly to usually Martlesham. It was an aerodrome in Essex, because that was quite a bit nearer to sort of to say Amsterdam or whatever, you see, wherever they went. So we could then spend more time actually escorting the bombers, you see, then we could spend quite a bit more time with them, actually.
Now, what were these, were there any differences in these, right? I mean, what was the scale of opposition to these daylight?
The opposition was always, that they always attracted enemy aircraft. So Fokkerplanes or Messerschmitts, and virtually whenever you escorted flying fortresses, you usually met opposition there, and it was And also, well, you also met Flack, because they were I saw one or, well, not one or two, but at least three or four fortresses being hit by Flack, actually. And sort of going down. One particular incident was, it was a horrible sight, really, because they think virtually disintegrated after being hit by Flack. With proper tactics, we were quite good at protecting the bombers from fighter aircraft, from Focke-Wulfs and from Messerschmitts. They usually couldn't really get at the fortresses there. Or it was much, we used to make them quite a bit more difficult for them, you see, there. They had their own tactics, you see, and they would fly at something about 30 or over 1,000 feet, and then they would be diving into the fortresses at great speed, you see. So that when they were sort of passing the fortresses, they would be flying at something about 450 knots, which was a hell of a speed. And with you flying at about 200 40 knots, escorting them, you see, there. It took a little time before you, even if you started, if you noticed the chap and started to intercept him, you see, it would be quite some time before you could actually make up, to get up to that speed, by which time, you see, they were gone. So there were sort of the tactics employed by the enemy fighters. They usually didn't take much notice of us, you see, the enemy fighters. They really were after the bombers.
Now, anything else about those raids? Or should the next thing, if not, is to move on to this dive bombing role?
Yes. Now, at the same time, we were being taught dive bombing, and that. We are mainly dive bombing of installations of that was a bit later actually, of the V1s, the launching sites of the V1s. You see, which were the. Well,
tell me about the training first. How did you train in this dive bomber role? Because we've mentioned the bombs before.
Yeah. Actual training was, well, you were told when to say, we would start diving at about sort of 6,000-7,000 feet or thereabouts, and then you would be you would dive at the virtually vertically aiming at the site where you were supposed to deposit your bombs, then at about, I suppose, 500-700 feet or so, you would release the bomb when you had it in your sight, in your bomb sight.
And what bombs were you carrying?
We would carry. Usually, a 500-kilogram bomb under the fuselage, or two 250 ones under the wings. You see, that was the usual thing. And you were told, you were shown on the map exactly where the thing would be. They were difficult to see from there because they were very well camouflaged actually, and you had to spot the damn thing first.
Now this is the V1.
That's right. Yes.
Installations.
Yes.
In the Padikkal area.
You're usually in the Padikkal area. Yes. And they would be taking off on a ramp, and they would virtually start underground. Really, and then you could see the. Or you were supposed to see the ramp with, but usually you were told exactly where the ramp was. You see, although you couldn't sort of see it more than not, as a ramp from the air, you see. But he knew exactly that it's in that particular corner of that particular wood or field that the, that you want to be, you see. The
so what would a typical attack on a V1 launcher be like? How would it go?
I beg your pardon?
What would a typical attack be like on a V1?
Well, you would fly depth at about 7,000-8,000 feet to your target area, and when you spotted the exact spot where you were going to, you would maneuver yourself into the right place to start the dive, and then at about 5,000-6,000 feet, you would release the bomb, and then get away. You knew.
Were you under a lot of fire?
But
were you under a lot of fire while you were doing this?
Yes. You knew that you were in the right place if there was a lot of fire, a lot of troops, because they were very heavily defended actually, and you could see the tracers going at you. And it usually seemed like a hail of bullets trying to get at you. You see, but there was nothing even that you could do about it. You just had to get on with it. You see, release your bombs and fly away again.
Would you take a photograph? I mean,
yes. Every time you activated your release, you see, you would take a photograph of exactly what you were aiming at, and so that they could then estimate exactly where the bombs would finish, whether you have actually hit anything there, or you were too wide, one way or the other.
Now, would your aircraft be hit during this? Would you get many hits on the aircraft during?
Yes. You usually came back with holes in your aircraft, and as I said, we didn't like it actually, because there was no sort of skill really attached to it all that much. You see, all I had to do is to bomb this, aim your aircraft and release the bombs and then fly away. You see, but there was no you couldn't do anything about the enemy fire at you. You see, if it were say, an escort or something like that, well, you could defend yourself against enemy aircraft, but there, you see, there's no, it was just luck and nothing else. Whether you were hit or not, and we lost quite a number of pilots actually of aircraft too.
I mean, it says you were particularly worried about the cooler system being.
Yes,
the engine.
Actually,
cooler.
It's not the cooler; it should mean cooling system. Yes. It's. You had two radiators under the just at the side of the fuselage under the wing, and they would be cooling the glycol, which was the main cooling. Well, it was the cooling agent for the engine, you see. Then, and if that was hit by a bullet and put out of action, then of course the engine would another few minutes, and the engine would seize up and catch fire. You see, there was no. So you just have to abandon the aircraft. You see, either jump out or land if you could land anywhere.
Now there's one and story of one pilot who lost his nerve.
Yes, and it's actually the same. And he's done it on several occasions until eventually he had to be sent away. When I was leading the squadron, we would all. So the 11 aircraft would come down, you see, following me, to dive bomb the thing. But this chap would remain at about 7,000-8,000 feet, you see, just circling around, you see, or he would release his bombs at that height. And then when I tackled him, and said later, so what happened to you, you see, then now, he said that he was trying to cover us from to make sure that there was no we weren't jumped on by another by enemy aircraft, you see. But of course, at that time there were no enemy aircraft in the sky. There might have been some aircraft in the sky, so 100 miles away, you see, but certainly not in that area there, you see. There. And he just couldn't take it. It was the same chap actually who nearly plowed into me.
On the takeoff
at Montfort Bridge, you see.
What did people think of him? I mean, how did they treat him?
There was no sort of animosity really on Hitler that, you see. We realized, you see, that well, it could have happened to anybody. He just couldn't take it, you see. There's no. You were actually, you see, the main thing there was that you were actually flying into a hail of bullets, and which was always a risk. And well, his nerves just couldn't stand it. And there was no. He was eventually taken off the. Well, soon after that, he was taken off operations altogether. You see, and then was that. In modern times, he would have been classed as, I don't know what you call them these days. I suppose in the First World War, he would have been shot, you see, for...
It would have been called cowardice.
Pardon?
Cowardice.
Yes. But then, you see, there was no animosity. We didn't sort of ostracize him because of that. He's not. You didn't want to fly with him again, really, as your wingman. You see, you prefer somebody else. You see, you only tolerated him. You see, if you had to fly with him, it was no deal. So it's a different story, but not.
So you were friendly with enough of him on the ground.
Yes. There was no. And in fact, I think a few months afterwards, or 6 months afterwards, I even went to his wedding. I mean, it was in Crawley in Sussex, where he was getting married. Actually, quite funny. Because, no, quite well. Only after and then lost contact. But about last year, I've read in a paper that he changed his name to an English name, and that he died. You see, so he must have been so eventually 80 or thereabouts when he, because a few years back, actually, he was still living in Sussex somewhere there.